Most countries are racing to build more clean energy. The Netherlands is uncovering what that future may entail. It may have gone too big, too soon, or in the wrong places. The grid is jammed, big industrial users can't get connections, and the demand that should soak up clean electricity, factories, heat pumps, EVs, isn't growing fast enough to match. And that's the bottleneck of the Dutch transition. And it's what today's guest spends her days trying to solve. Karen runs the asset-based energy business at Eneco, one of the Netherlands' largest utilities. They build and operate the critical components: wind farms, solar parks, batteries, trading desks, and district heat networks. But in the Netherlands, grid capacity has run out and projects are stalling. Some developers are turning to non-firm connections or co-locating new loads like data centers, greenhouses, and industrial e-boilers right next to where that power is generated. It's a workaround, but it's faster, cheaper, and increasingly necessary. Even batteries, an obvious fix, face their own hurdles. In the Netherlands, they're treated like grid users, which means high tariffs and lower profits, effectively being double charged. That's encouraged companies like Eneco to build storage in neighboring Germany and Belgium, where regulation is better adapted to the changing technology mix, even though the Netherlands arguably needs those batteries more. And this is reshaping how projects get financed. Karen says the age of merchant renewables, so projects that live or die by market prices alone, is fading. Eneco's strategy reflects a pragmatic approach to this challenge. They balance renewables with short-term flexible assets like batteries and longer-term backup, still gas, for now. They're also building smarter demand, flexible electrification, dynamic tariffs, and virtual power plants that shift consumption automatically when the grid needs it. If you can't make a system bigger, the theory goes, you should focus on trying to make it smarter. So, whilst this is a Dutch story, it's also a preview of what can happen elsewhere. When ambition outpaces infrastructure, the problem isn't generating clean power. It's connecting it, storing it, finding the right kind of demand to use it. Building renewables is phase one. Making the most of them on a crowded, interconnected network, that's the real challenge. So, welcome back to Transmission. Let's dive in. Hello, Karen, and welcome to Transmission.
Thanks, Ed. It's nice to be here.
Very good. And let's jump in with our standard question. So, who are you and what's your role in Eneco?
My name is Karen de Lathouder. It's a very Dutch name. Don't try to pronounce it. I work for a Dutch energy company called Eneco. And my role in Eneco is I'm in charge of the asset-based value chains. What does that mean? It's the value chains that have the steel, so to say, the production of electricity. So the value chains I lead are heat. So we produce, distribute, and sell heat. Renewable power. We produce and sell renewable power, so wind turbines, solar energy, batteries. And also flex, that's like the normal gas flex. And also batteries and new flex, so hydrogen development, et cetera. So those value chains end to end, from building the assets to operating assets to trading the energy, those three value chains report to me.
Okay, and it's a little bit of kind of the traditional in terms of, say, gas flex, but as well sort of batteries and hydrogen coming through in your role. For people not so familiar with Eneco, would you like to just describe who they are, where they're based, kind of key markets?
Yeah, so Eneco is a Dutch integrated energy company, which means we generate our own power and we trade in power and gas, and then we deliver that to our customers. And those can be both households or businesses. And we're not only active in the Netherlands, but as well in Germany, Belgium, and the UK. We're very small in the UK, but we're active here. And we have about 2.5 gigawatts of own renewable assets installed. And we have around 4,000 employees, and we're headquartered in Rotterdam.
Okay, amazing. And just to give people a little bit of a sort of split between sort of the more, I suppose, traditional side and then some of the newer techs coming through, what would you say the balance is between some of the sort of more gas-oriented to some of the more hydrogen and battery-oriented business chains at the moment?
Well, we're very ambitious in terms of renewable energy. Our ambition is to be climate neutral in 2035. So since 2007, we've been very actively shifting from traditional gas fired power plants to more renewable-based assets, but also helping our customers decarbonize completely. So we've shifted our portfolio massively from gas towards renewables. As in every market, I think we still need a bit of gas flex. So we have that to balance and to trade. But in general, we're more and more shifting towards renewable power, maybe the last 10 years. Now we see the market is really in a new phase where demand is kind of stagnating and it doesn't work to just build renewables, but you need balance. So we're moving into batteries, hydrogen, e-boilers, so new flex to actually balance and make our own portfolio more resilient.
Yeah. And I'm going to come on in a second to ask you a little question around the Netherlands and how do the power markets work in the Netherlands. But you just mentioned there around demand stagnating. I think actually it's one of those trends across Europe that's really interesting. Every time you see a kind of forecast, you see the demand kind of moving upwards, right? Because we expect electrification of vehicles, electrification of heating, and you kind of think, okay, well, this demand is coming. How sort of pan-European is that trend for demand being quite flat?
I think we see it across the board. Maybe in different countries, there might be different reasons. In some places, it's congestion-based, so a company can't electrify because there's no grid connection. Specifically for the Netherlands, I would say there's a bit of uncertainty in industry of, well, the future and their investments. So the investment climate for industry to, you know, are we still going to be there in 10 years, holds them back a little bit to electrify. So you almost get a chicken and egg situation because they can generate the demand, but there's uncertainty there, which means there's going to be uncertainty in the renewable projects, such as wind offshore, which is really, for the Netherlands, the biggest source for electrification of industry, mm-hmm. And also for our hydrogen market. And so none of them is moving. So one has to move first, and that is typically what we see in the Netherlands.
I think it's a really nice description of kind of the log jam a little bit that's in power markets at the moment. And you just brought in the Netherlands. So let's do that. Let's talk about how do power markets work in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I would say, let me say a little bit about market design. So it's more technical. And then what does that mean for us as a Dutch energy company operating in it? So the Dutch electricity market is liberalized. It means production, trade, and transport of electricity are separated and companies can freely compete in this market. And the most important market in the Netherlands is day ahead, and most electricity is traded through that market. And companies exchange their bids in advance and then, you know, get settled. TenneT, the Dutch transmission system operator, ensures that supply and demand obviously are matched. And the parties must predict upfront how much they will supply and consume. So we are responsible for that ourselves. And the deviations are settled afterwards in the imbalance market, which we can bid on quarterly. Prices are determined per hour for the day ahead, and they can fluctuate greatly depending on basically the weather, if the sun shines and the wind blows, and also by international electricity flows, because the Netherlands is very connected. Saying that, it means that we are strongly connected to our neighboring countries, so Belgium and Germany, but also UK. We trade electricity international in that way. So that's a bit of a description of the Dutch market. Okay. Now, what does it mean to operate in there? It's a very small market. We're a densely populated country, but geographically, we're small.
And in the Netherlands, what does peak demand look like? What does the generation mix look like?
Yeah, the peak demand would be about 18 gigawatts, and the mix of that is like 50% renewable. And that peak demand is predicted to grow in the coming 5 years to about 21, 22 gigawatts.
Okay, very interesting. And then obviously your focus is on asset management. So what is the latest in the sort of power purchase agreement and flexibility markets in the Netherlands?
Most of our renewable sources, we actually only build them at the moment if there's a PPA connected, and that's usually B2B because it's larger volume. So the Googles, the Amazons of this world, mm-hmm. And we supply B2B mainly for our renewable assets. That is just literally for more security of the investment.
Okay, I definitely saw something recently where Eneco had been providing something to Google as part of a PPA for one of their data centers that they're looking to put in the Netherlands, which is...
Yeah, early on in time, we used to have a lot of merchant projects, mm-hmm. but I think in the last 5 years, we had none of them. And we actually only build, especially the larger wind offshore, it's a prerequisite that we have a good PPA in place before we even take FID.
And that's true for you, but is that also true for the general market? So many fewer sites coming through on a merchant basis?
Yeah, I would say so. Especially Netherlands, Germany, we see the same. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you just see that the needed curtailment at times, you need to have certainty of your power being supplied to somewhere. Because I said before that the demand is stagnating a little bit, so it's harder to really make sure that you find an offtaker of your power at the moment.
Yes, and I suppose, is that also true across Europe as well, because you're active in multiple regions?
Yeah, we see the same in Germany and Belgium, and also in the UK, we see the same. We won't build, for example, a new wind development in Scotland without being very, very certain that we have a PPA in place. Right.
I almost thought you were going to say we won't build it unless it's co-located with storage.
That's the second point.
Which probably brings me onto the flexibility side. So how do you see that co-location?
Yeah, so that's another trend we see definitely operating in our geographies. Almost everywhere we see that we shift towards co-location. And I see two types of co-location. The most common one that jumps to mind is to put a battery next to your wind farm or put a battery next to your solar farm. Because what we're actually doing right now is we're throwing away beautiful renewable electricity that we generate half of the time, because it's just not needed at the time that it's actually being generated, because sun and wind usually during the day, we come home and we want to charge our car in the evening. So you need to prevent that you throw that energy away, and batteries, flex is the best way to do that. But if you talk about really congested places, such as the Netherlands, like Port of Rotterdam, for an example, large wind offshore gigawatts of electricity are going to land there. And to prevent that, you need to make really big grid fortifications. You could think putting an electron sink right close to where the electricity lands, so use it close to where it's being generated, is another form of co-location. Mm-hmm. And we're increasingly looking at our portfolio in this way. How can we combine electron sinks yes. with electron generation? Just because the fact that demand is stagnating, and this is also a way to create demand and therefore build a bit more, well, positive business case for example, wind offshore.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing this in loads of regions. So as we start to kind of grow the generation mix, as adding wind and solar, and demand is starting to move in some places, grid doesn't necessarily always keep up. And so that kind of bites in two places. You kind of get this lack of connection offers, but then you also get this these constraints kind of emerging on the grid, which means even if you have the generation, you can't get it to where you want to get it to. And so from your side, you're both... perhaps is a question, but on one side you're thinking about, okay, where can we put our battery and our flexibility so that we can make the most of the sites? Is it more being driven by that, or are you also seeing the sort of the problem that is everywhere, which is I just can't get grid connections fast enough, and so if I want to deploy storage, then I kind of have to blend it with solar or wind when I put those sites onto the grid?
Yeah, we see both. I think talking about batteries, the issue in the Netherlands is mainly grid cost, grid fees, because we have a slightly different system of socializing grid cost in the Netherlands, which leads to very high grid tariffs. And they are charged because the battery is seen as a user, whereas I fundamentally believe that a battery should be part of the electricity system, of the power system, because it actually helps. So in the Netherlands, the cost usually is the issue for a battery. And in Germany and Belgium, we see that we're building batteries, and we usually find ways to get the connection. It has waiting times, but not out of proportions. Okay. Whereas the UK is obviously much further into battery development, and you guys have a different situation.
Yeah, we are going to do a podcast on connection timelines in the UK. We will be here for a couple of hours, I'm sure.
Yeah, and something that's maybe interesting for you is, in the Netherlands we have a type of a contract with the TSO. It's a non-firm ATO. And what it means is you actually say, okay, about 85% of time, you're completely certain that you can use your connection to take or give power to the grid with your battery. And 15% of time, the TSO can say, no, we're full or we're congested. And those contracts, grid connections, are fairly easy to get. And they also make sure that some of these battery business cases are now moving towards more positive, because you can actually get the connection.
Yes. And I think if you're a data center and somebody says, oh, by the way, it's 85% firm, they'll go, well, no, thank you, I can't do that. But a battery, provided that sort of firmness is at the right times, is just absolutely not a problem. I think we also see some exciting things, for example, in the US, in SPP, which is one of the regions in the US, you can also have sort of accelerated timelines if you're looking to co-locate rather than getting a... just if you're looking to add on batteries to an existing site rather than bring a new site through. And I think there's a few things like that where grid operators might want to think about how do they get these flexible assets that actually help the system onto the system faster. Yeah. And but both those are really kind of, I suppose, good examples of that. To kind of flip this round to look at the consumer side for the Netherlands, how do we change costs, or how do we lower costs for consumers in the Netherlands?
Yeah, this is a big thing. Consumers being both businesses, industry, and actual like us end users. I think one of the big things in the Netherlands is the grid fees. As I just said, they're huge, and the net requires more expansions over the coming years. And what we do now is we don't socialize the costs for the current and the future users, but we actually charge them to the existing users, which makes it a very high grid tariff. So, for example, if you want to build an electrolyzer to make green hydrogen, about 50% of the cost of it is power, mm-hmm. OPEX. So that makes it almost impossible to even start your project. So both industry themselves, if they want to electrify, it means they'll use electricity, but their grid fees, of course, will be proportionally increased. So it halters the case for electrification. So it's actually a double break. There's the net congestion, and then there's the grid fees, and it's completely holding back the demand development in the Netherlands that we so much need to go from 50% renewables to even a bigger share.
Yeah, and I suppose there's kind of a really interesting part in that, where if your grid fees become a larger amount, and then people start to go, well, look, these grid fees are very expensive, I can get solar panels, I can get a battery, and I can put it on my own factory, I can put it on my own industrial site, and I can avoid those grid fees by having my own generation on site, then all of a sudden you're seeing less volume coming through the network. And again, it then starts to, because that's a fixed cost, the cost of the network, that then starts to become a higher and higher cost for all of the rest of the people still connected to the network. And so it's kind of the theme of this whole conversation, I think, so far, is we've got this element of which way are we going? Are we going to be able to release some of those grid fees by having more demand, by having more flexibility and sort of get those grid fees down? Or there's sort of the spiral of kind of much higher costs as people look to leave the network. How much sort of behind the meter generation do you see coming through in the Netherlands? Is it a big trend?
It's growing. In terms of what Eneco develops. In Belgium, we're really big at that. So our B2B portfolio is really all about developing solutions for companies like Volvo Truck. They built electric trucks in Belgium. And we have there a couple of wind turbines, all their roofs covered with solar panels. Mm-hmm. And we help them optimize power. So in Belgium, our portfolio B2B is very big. In the Netherlands, we're setting this up. And we're looking mainly at the mid-sized company, and we have an offer called Green Building, we call it. And we help smaller, medium-sized businesses to really optimize their energy use for their building or their offices. So that's growing, and we see a lot of behind-the-meter projects actually still very good in terms of returns. So that's where we're going. Mm-hmm. And as you said, we do need it, because I really believe that local solutions are part of the solution. So the role of customers in flexing and preventing unnecessary and expensive grid expansions, balanced with, okay, how do we socialize the costs of the existing grid expansions, which we do need? So that's really a balance that we need to look at. And I think it requires a bit of smart thinking with multiple parties about the grid design locally. So local solutions come together locally with the community, with the province, with the TSO, DSO, and energy producer. And you can find really brilliant solutions that prevent expensive, grid building, because you find other solutions. So I do think behind the meter, batteries, generation is very, very important. But you have to make sure that you coordinate it and you don't build a big grid next door.
Quick break. If you listen to this show, then you probably work in energy. And at Modo Energy, we're not just talking about the energy transition. We help our users to actually make it happen. All energy storage, solar, and wind assets on the global balance sheet need to be valued and benchmarked. And that's where Modo Energy comes in. Our benchmarks and forecasts are transparent, bankable, and trusted by the world's leading banks, asset managers, utilities, and developers. So if you want to learn more, go to modoenergy.com. And if you want more content like this, sign up to our weekly dispatch newsletter. Enjoy the conversation.
And I suppose there are a few sort of emerging technologies, I would say, not so much emerging, but you've got things like vehicle to grid, you've got community batteries. You also mentioned sort of hydrogen projects coming through. Of those kind of like a portfolio of a few things coming through at the same time, which of those are you sort of most bullish on? Which do you sort of like the most as a new tech?
I would say batteries is for us the most important, but it's a combination of digitalization on our end. So we have a large VPP, virtual power plant, that actually connects all our assets and then optimizes curtailment use. Where does the electricity go? Where is it generated? So it's like our back office is innovated in that way. But on the other side, as I said before, I think the trick is into balancing generation and use, either by co-location or by thinking smartly about offers that you can have. So just building renewable assets, that was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was really good to get us where we are. But right now we need to think, how can we create a network that prevents expensive grid fortifications by coming up with smart stuff. So dynamic pricing, for example. We have a small customer group that's really active and they like it. They like to see that that they can charge their car for lower prices because of the dynamic pricing, or that they switch their washing machine on when power is cheap. Those are the front runners. Not everybody likes that, but I think the role of the consumer is heavily underestimated in solving this issue. So any offer that is aimed there, dynamic pricing, e-mobility, how can we combine e-mobility with a smart grid in a town or in an area? Mm-hmm. But for example, we also look bigger. If I look at the national grid in the Netherlands, something we do is we help the port electrify. So we call it shore power, mm-hmm. where the big ships come in and they don't, you know, use their diesel to while they're docked and while they're loaded, but we plug them in. There's literally a big plug that goes in, and they are connected to the electricity grid, and it helps reduce emissions in the shipping industry. Mm-hmm. But it's also a very handy electron sink where you have wind onshore landing. So, and another good example that we do is we call our business part, that's called agro energy. Mm-hmm. The Netherlands has a really big industry in terms of the greenhouses, and we work with a lot of greenhouse companies to see how can we optimize their heating and their energy use smartly, because it's also an electron sink, together with behind the meter solutions or VPP use. So those are actually co-location, but in the bigger sense of the word.
I'm not sure whether an energy historian would correct me on this, but I think that a lot of the first aggregation and VPP type technologies that came in GB in the sort of mid-teens actually had track records from working with those greenhouses and the CHPs in the Netherlands. And that was actually part of the sort of where the technology originally came from. So you sort of lent it to us. We took that and brought it through in terms of battery optimization, whatever it might be. And now I think it's perhaps coming sort of back full circle as well as GB starts to export a lot of what we've done in the battery space back to the continent. So there's definitely...
Yeah, and the VPP space, obviously Kraken is a really good example. But there are more solutions. And I think our VPP that we develop in-house is a similar system, very, very strong in optimization of flex, but also just optimization of the trading part.
Okay, so we've jumped about in this a little bit. So we've talked about electrification of ports, we've talked about V2G, we have talked about community batteries, we've mentioned hydrogen very briefly. We've covered a lot of these individual parts, but I want to kind of come back to that sort of fundamental. So how are you positioning Eneco as markets evolve? That much more general question, because it feels like you're in loads of places. You obviously oversee all of these sort of the assets and the strategy around those assets. So how do you kind of keep a vision? Because that is so many things to be looking at.
Yeah, and I think if I zoom out completely, that the starting point of it is that since 2007, we had a very brave CEO and he said, we're going to go all renewables. And the whole country said, well, this company's crazy, it's going to go down. And we're still here. And we actually showed that you can do that. We made it work and we found our niche in that. So that's the starting point. And we sort of wrote that up in a plan called the OPP, the One Planet Plan, we call it. And that's actually why people come to work with us, because it's quite famous in the Netherlands. What the OPP does, it says how we feel that we should treat each other and the earth. So it's also about energy poverty. It's about the social aspect of being a company. So it's more ESG related. But the bigger part of it is climate. And we set really strong ambitions to be climate neutral in 2035. We're actually biodiversity net plus, so 110% better for each project since 2025. And circularity, completely circular in 2050. So that's the starting point of everything we do. That's embedded in our strategy since 2019. And also we get, well, our KPIs, OKRs, if you want, mm-hmm. Are on that. So I have to, especially in my area, the assets, I have to be mindful of emissions.
Yeah.
So that's the starting point. Then you go into the energy transition, where at first it was build, build, build. And that was easy, right? Fairly simple. Now we come where that doesn't work anymore. So you can just see that returns, which are still important for our shareholder, are declining. It's a massive capital-intensive industry, the asset business. So how do you deal with making sure that the returns are still in line with the risk that you take? So then the answer is you must have a balanced portfolio, which is our strength, right? We have assets, integrations of trade, and customers. So by nature, our portfolio is very resilient for all seasons. So that's how we look at it. And now we're coming to a point where we say we must go one level up in this thinking. So how do we design a portfolio that is still growing, resilient in terms of, well, look at the energy crisis, right? The energy crisis, gas flex and renewables together actually caused us to steer through it really, really nicely. So resilience in your portfolio and be ready for any extremity helps a lot. So the things I look at mostly when I look at the whole portfolio is how do we still go towards decarbonizing the system and how do we do whatever we do in line of that? So first, strategic fit. Then it is how do we optimize capital? Because it is capital intensive and you could spend it. Yeah, you could spend your capital on many things. So capital optimization, which is return versus risk or return versus resilience of your portfolio. And then I think the last thing is how do we deal with the actualities in the market? Mm. Net congestion, what you thought on paper actually doesn't work. So you have to, on the ground, optimize your portfolio. And then you move towards what kind of offers, propositions, business models do we look to invest that capital, which has shifted from, just build wind farms towards smart co-location, sinks and energy production, etc. So it's actually a three-step approach, if I could describe it.
Yeah, I actually really like that. So I really like the sort of the first element, which is sort of the vision and the strategy. The second element, which is, you sort of mentioned it a few times in there, but the resilience element. So I think often people sort of look at solar or wind or battery storage, and somebody sort of starts mentioning a sort of levelized cost of energy, and you think, well, that's lovely. But in fact, in reality, when you're managing a portfolio of this, the resilience and your independence from gas prices from other parts of the world, that becomes a really sort of critical part of how you actually deliver on this strategy and how you kind of keep shareholders happy with sort of at the same time as making the transition, you are also making a more resilient portfolio. I think it's a really nice way of sort of positioning it.
Yeah, and imagine we're trying to use a grid that was designed for gas flex, basically, or coal to fire whenever it was needed. And we're trying to use that grid, how it was designed, for a bunch of renewables that do what they do, right? The sun doesn't always shine. You have a day and night rhythm, the wind. So also geographical optimization becomes important of your portfolio.
And I think you have, with such a large portfolio, with all these assets within it, you now have some new additions coming in. So utility scale batteries are coming in. How do you think about those? What are the best markets for you?
Well, utility scale batteries are extremely important for our portfolio, especially since the amount of renewables in the mix is current in the Netherlands at 50. It's going to go up more. So inherently, you're going to have an energy production that is not flat. So you need batteries. You need flex. So short-term flex, which is batteries, long-term flex, which at the moment is only gas flex, right? Hydrogen isn't working yet. Long-duration energy storage is not viable. So we need those two types of flex, the hourly flex, which is batteries, and then the actual flex that you can battle a dunkelflaute with, which means dunkelflaute. I don't know if everybody knows what it is, but it means there is actually no energy production from the renewables and you need something else in that case. So we use batteries to balance our own portfolio of sustainable assets. So we use the VPP for that. But I also think they're essential, especially in the Netherlands, with grid congestion and also optimizing grid expansions, to balance the grid. Mm-hmm. So they have a double function. So I strongly believe you need to put them where they're needed, not just put them to put them, which is a big discussion in the Netherlands where a lot of connections or applications for batteries are, I think they're in the wrong place. So again, searching for local solutions and talking to each other instead of just doing what you did for the last, 50 years is really essential. So
I really like the description you have of how you're adding those batteries, both to deal with the sort of variation in terms of generation, but also calling for transparency on networks in terms of where there are pinch points, where there are high cost parts for the network, and how batteries can help to resolve those.
Yeah, the funny thing is we need them a lot in the Netherlands, but it's completely stagnating. So currently my portfolio is building big projects in Germany. We just took FID on two big batteries, and also in Belgium, build a big battery, and another two FIDs are coming up. In the Netherlands, we only have one in our portfolio, and that sort of stumbled through the hurdle rate, so to get enough returns, just because it's sharing a grid connection with one of our power plants. Yeah. So we need them a lot, but due to the grid fees again, it's very difficult to actually get these business cases to a level where it's acceptable for the shareholder and ready to invest.
And so this is batteries essentially facing grid fees that don't really welcome the flexibility that battery brings. And that means that those batteries are, as you say, less attractive in comparison to building a site in Germany or building a site in Belgium.
Yeah, because the Dutch energy system sees them like users. Mm. Whereas in Belgium, you get, and in Germany, discounts to grid tariffs because they're helping. And in the Netherlands, well, you're a user of the grid, so you have to pay the tariffs. Whereas I would say no, make it part of the grid.
Yeah.
And then you can reduce the tariffs for everyone.
And this conversation is happening everywhere. So grid designs, grid tariffs are generally made, as you say, in the world of gas flex or consumers just having 24/7 base load, whatever it might be. And actually the flexibility that batteries can bring to those networks genuinely isn't really factored into those charges. And so we're seeing that same conversation happening all over the globe, actually, which is really interesting. You mentioned one thing about there being variations in generation, and then you also mentioned there being constraints. Interested that you didn't mention demand, and I wonder if we think about the port of Rotterdam, which you brought up earlier, the demand for that site must be all over the place in terms of as large ships come in. Do you see there's a role in terms of some of those large-scale batteries being sort of alongside the port as well?
Yeah, the battery that we're currently looking at our power plant is in the port.
Okay.
So that's very useful there. So the port has some really good opportunities, which is shore power, for example, but also is very much under threat because the big refineries are in the port. They can electrify partly, but also they are in a situation in the European, industry politics and say, do we need this? Where do we need it? So there's a lot of uncertainty in the port, and I think the port needs to look for new solutions of baseload. So I'm thinking data centers, energy hubs, where the wind lands. So shore power is good for that. But again, in the port, it's where we would hope demand would pick up in terms of electrification. But the companies that need to electrify are usually big multinationals, and they see their investments really somewhere else at the moment because there's just a lot of uncertainty about industry and the future of industry, especially under ETS and under Europe, whereas the Draghi report clearly suggests that we should treasure our industry and help it. I see, especially the Netherlands, mainly around with sticks, where the Germans are a bit more generous with their carrots, and therefore you can see that stuff starting to pick up, including hydrogen.
And to kind of have that theme running all the way back through again, you absolutely have to have large industry, large demand to be able to share out some of the fixed costs. And if you don't have those things, then you start to get decreasing demand, which raises higher costs on the remaining consumers, which means higher costs, lower growth. And so you can see how there's a lot of these feedback loops within some of these parts of industry. And that's why it's so important, I think, to have, as you say, almost like a carrot-based approach where you're encouraging demand to come onto these systems.
Yeah, we have a 75 gigawatt offshore ambition. That's really far out, though. Mm-hmm. But it should be at least 21 gigawatts in 2030. We're never going to make that at the pace we're going right now because demand is not coming. So that every business case for the tenders, the last tender was published yesterday, no bids. Mm-hmm. So I'm really concerned about wind offshore generating the demand because imagine it's 8 to 10 years pipeline, right? So right now the business case doesn't fly. Mm-hmm. But it means that's a park, that's a farm that's built in 8 years from now. And then the demand might be there. But if we wake up then we still need 8 years to actually build it. So the mechanism to make sure that we take away the big risk for these projects to be built by us, by the developers, is, for instance, an SDE++ or a contract for difference, like you see in Belgium. The Netherlands is very hesitant with offering contract for difference. I think we need it, one, to not stop, to not create a stop and go in the supply chain of wind offshore, because it means companies will go away and you won't build them because they'll go somewhere else. And two, to make sure that when the demand rises, we have what we have. So you need to look forward instead of where are we now.
And we see a lot of that narrative, like what's happening in Netherlands mirrors GB. So we're going through this process at the moment. We're trying to hit clean power 2030. We've just had an allocation round, so we're coming up to an allocation round 7. I'm sorry, this is recorded on the 31st of October. So we haven't had allocation round 7 yet, but we have seen the budget for it. And the budget for it is not really procuring as much volume as the kind of larger plan for clean power 2030 said. So we've kind of, as you say, we should be thinking with an 8 or 10 year hat on, but we are stumbling at the moment on just sort of making those costs and making those risks work to try and encourage people to come and build those offshore wind sites.
Yeah, but I think that's very similar in the Netherlands. The TSO is expecting a shocking 10 gigawatts of batteries in 2033 to stabilize our system. And at the moment, we're struggling to build the first ones, as I said, to the business case. And the same for wind offshore. The agenda is very ambitious, but the tenders are there's no bidders. Mm. So we really have to redesign and rethink where are we and how do we get demand going? Because that's really that will unlock all the rest.
And there's almost like with some of the areas that haven't yet had as large a fleet of battery storage installed, there is something of a second mover advantage. So if I look at, say, California and CAISO, so the description of their system, they have something like 13 gigs but 50 gigawatt hours of battery storage already there. So the blueprint of how to build these very large battery sites already exists. And so it's not a sort of technological hurdle around this. It's absolutely doable. As you say, it kind of comes down to de-risking the investment and making sure that we have the connections available.
Yes. And in the Netherlands, it's space.
Okay.
Because we're very densely populated. In the US, you can find an empty space and build a data center with a little, gas turbine with it. In the Netherlands, you have to really search for space.
Okay.
That's an extra complexity.
That is. So you obviously oversee a very large portfolio. Perhaps putting one of your sort of senior management hats on, like what are the sort of top risks in that portfolio today?
I would say volatility is a big risk, which we're managing by ensuring we have enough flex. Mm-hmm. And that's also why we look at resilience. It's also exposure, because due to the volatility, the price ranges are massive. So you look at exposure and how to protect from that. I think it's building a resilient portfolio and being an integrated energy company.
Okay. And so in some senses, this is around the growth of negative prices within Europe. And so if you go back to, say, 2022, you'd be worried about volatility in terms of very peaky prices. In this case, I suppose you're talking about very negative prices from a generation perspective.
Yeah. And yes. And of course, the risks we all mentioned, the increasing cost of the grid, which is hampering demand, basically, and congestion. So cost and congestion are more inside out or outside in risks.
Yeah.
So you have the contextual risks of the country or the market that are slightly different per geography where we operate. And then we have the inherent portfolio risks, mm-hmm. which is, the portfolio response to price, to volatility and to exposure, because that's in the end, if you're a big asset company, that what you do is manage risk. Mm-hmm. But for me, I would say risks are always opportunities. So higher volatility for me means we should invest in flex. Demand stagnation means we need to look at electron sinks, so shore power, e-mobility, and find balance in our portfolio. Data centers. How do we manage in the Netherlands a wind offshore electron generation with a data center baseload? And net congestion really leads to looking at co-location and looking at electron sinks next to where you produce, so you really prevent extra grid fortifications and vertical integration at a country level. So how are we a bit smarter with our grid? So all these risks for me are opportunities for the next 5 to 10 years. And one other thing to mention, I think for us, the demand risk, we are at the same time trying to create the demand as fill the demand. And I think a really good example is industrial electrification. So we try to look at companies that need power at a certain time of day, not baseload, but actually flex. Mm-hmm. So we say, okay, when power prices are low, your whatever French fries factory or drinks factory switches from gas-fired to electrical or other heat solutions. So it's heat storage, industrial heat storage, mm-hmm. and literally an e-boiler. So for Heineken, Dutch company, Dutch brewer, we build a big e-boiler in their process, and it fires when electricity prices are low, and when electricity prices are high, they use their normal system. And the business case of those are very, very positive.
Mm. And I think there is a massive lesson in there in terms of trying to work out ways of getting industrial scale flex through. All of that comes from good transparency on pricing, the ability to be able to expose those end customers to those very peak prices or those very low prices so they can make decisions around flexing how they run their plant.
Yeah, and if you make enough of that, you can actually help flex the grid. There's some industry there that's less flexible, I would say. Big refineries are less flexible. They have a turn down rate of about 10%. They can flex 10%. Otherwise, the process doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. But shore power, e-boilers in an industrial process that has an alternative, they're very good sources of flex.
Mm-hmm. And I think this has been, for listeners, I think it's a fantastic sort of oversight and sort of getting also like underneath the bonnet of like how a really large utility thinks about some of these transition themes and also, as you say, how you're making opportunities out of some of the risks as well. I think that's it's a really nice framing, and I hope that there are a lot of people listening to that who will think, yeah, okay, I love that I'm going to be taking that to my next board meeting. And maybe they'll be quoting you, Karen. We'll see. So that brings me on to my final two questions that I would like to ask. So the first one is there anything in particular that you would like to plug?
Yeah, I would say it's two things I would like to plug. One is just very personal. I'm a very avid mountaineer. And last years, I come into the mountains and I literally see the glaciers melt. From every year I go to Italy to the Nefeti hut, they have a ladder to get into the hut where you used to be able to step from the glacier into the hut. Every year I get there, a new piece is added. And now it's actually a very scary 30-meter climb. And I see this and it makes me incredibly sad because this is, you know, it's irreversible. And my concern for the climate and for this earth that we have to pass on to next generation is why I do what I do. And I can't stress enough that it's 2 to 12, or maybe it's already 2 past 12 for this problem. And climate and the energy transition seems to have become less important to many people, including politicians. And it's the time to reverse course. And the energy transition is literally hitting a little speed bump because of everything we discussed today. You know, demand is not going where we want it to be, grid congestion, grid cost. But there's still, what I would like to say is there's still many things we can do to make progress and to find support into smaller solutions. We can do things. And the great thing about that is, like, secondary to it is sustainable energy doesn't just make our lives better, as in the climate, but it also helps in terms of energy independence. And that's a big theme at the moment in Europe, which is a secondary theme to say, well, if we find that important, then we can push the climate agenda a little bit. So we shift to autonomy as a first argument, but then it has energy transition in its wake, which is very good.
And I'd like, so here, I totally agree with everything you've just said. And I think maybe I'll add one thing to it, which is that if you're thinking about the plans coming through, there is both a need to think about the 8 to 10 year horizon and maybe that sort of offshore wind plant that's coming through. But there's also, I think there would be great if industry has a sort of healthy skepticism of sort of stuff coming through in 2040 plus. You know, this isn't an issue that we have 10 years to sit on and then make a decision on. Actually, the run hours for the gas fleet, the run hours for the coal fleet, whatever that might be, we need to bring that down ASAP, make the savings as quickly as we can. We don't need to get to 100% renewable tomorrow. If we could just shift the dial in terms of the renewable penetration in many grids, that would make a huge difference.
And I think trying to go to zero fossil fuels is going to be hugely expensive. But if you go to 90%, for example, and you accept a little bit of fossil fuel in the mix, you can do way more. Because you can invest your money not in that last 10% that's very difficult to abate, but decarbonize customers or other solutions. So that's very important.
Okay. You had another one to plug.
Yeah, it's just something I want to share because it's so cool at what we do at Eneco. I told you about biodiversity. Mm-hmm. So since this year, every single one of our projects has to leave the place where we build it 10% better in terms of biodiversity than when we found it. So all our projects contribute positively to biodiversity. And this goes from in a city in the Netherlands where we build a heat station to distribute heat, we also have to leave biodiversity better in the middle of the city. So what we did is we talked to the council and we said, what do you need? And they said, well, you guys have an ecologist. We have actually our own ecologist at Eneco, or two actually. And we said, well, let's have a look. And we built a citywide plan to increase biodiversity over the city for them in return. Another great one is we built three turbines, or we didn't build three turbines actually, in a place in the Netherlands, because there's a nearby gathering place of a special bird. And we said, well, we want to build turbines here, but we will never be able to protect this bird, so biodiversity would go down. So we don't take the investment decision, we leave it.
Okay.
And that's really cool that we look at it this way.
Mm. Which is the city you were looking at in the first example?
Schiedam.
Okay.
So in the Netherlands, yeah.
If you are walking around there and you see additional biodiversity, then...
If you see new trees and plants and stuff coming up, it's probably because we helped design where to put what in the best way in town.
I love that. And then moving on, so your final question, is there a contrarian view that you hold?
Yeah, I thought about it last night and I actually had three, and maybe I'll tell you them and then we dive into one that excites you most. I would say... and maybe it's not contrarian because the world picked up, but I would say flexibility and decentralization are underestimated in terms of looking at the grid, and this is maybe more so for the Netherlands. The second one, I think we all know it, but we're still not acting, is the role of consumers or prosumers is fundamentally underestimated in how we do what we do. Mm-hmm. So we're still looking at the big projects, but we don't really get the latent flex that we have in all of our networks. I think the UK is ahead, though. And the last one is maybe the most interesting one. Renewables is not always the cheapest choice on the short term. So you need to look at total cost of ownership and longer term. And I think we touched upon it already, right? You need to have this 8 to 10 year hat on.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple of views that I thought, well, they're not unknown, but somehow they don't get enough traction.
Agreed. I think the last one is perhaps my favorite, which is that I think it is kind of calling for, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, that actually in a lot of this transition, people appear to have forgotten about some things. They appear to have forgotten about the progress we're trying to make and where we're trying to get that system to in terms of resilience and independence. And actually, it is refreshing to hear that 2035 plan, how you are executing it and how you have that longer term vision. So I love that as a contrarian view. I suppose how do you embody that in a sort of day to day within your role?
Yeah, especially in the Netherlands, the simple thought is renewable energy is always cheaper. And that's a logical future. I believe that, but I also believe we do need a little bit of fossil in the mix. So for example, if you say everything needs to decarbonize at the same time, so society and the power plants, you make your life incredibly difficult. Whereas if you would say, do it staggered, keep the power plants on a little bit longer, it's a tiny bit of CO2 because they have, 1,000 run hours a year? And then you can decarbonize a much larger part of society. So it's thinking about it with a bit more nuance and say, if you just push for renewables and say, well, all power plants must be hydrogen fired, the country will go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And if you accept that there is a place for a little bit of fossil fuels for a way longer time than we expected initially, and there's a bunch of reports, recent McKinsey report as well, suggesting that this is where we are. So yes, renewables is the way to go, but a little bit more nuanced and cross the board, cut through and kind of almost step over some of the more logical short-term solutions that include CO2 capture and storage, power plants versus the rest of the landscape, net optimization, system costs. So in the short term, variable renewable sources often cause additional system costs. We know this, balancing, congestion, extra infrastructure. And then we almost forget that we can think of hybrid solutions. And for me, hybrid solutions, if I talk to my colleagues at GasUnie, the state-owned gas distributor, We actually agree wholeheartedly that hybrid solutions are the future, like the ones I talked about before at Heineken. Mm-hmm. They have their normal system and they have an e-boiler. And the total cost versus how much emission you save is massive in the first step. So yes, renewables, but I think as a sort of intermediate step, think about hybrid solutions. Think about blue hydrogen before green, you know?
Yeah.
So it's almost like, are you very dogmatic about it or pragmatic about climate change?
I think that is a perfect place to end it. And when we started this conversation, it was cloudy and rainy outside. And I think it was all a bit downbeat. And as we've kind of gone through this very wide-ranging but extremely pragmatic approach to managing these very large investments, but also how do we get the sort of best out of this for consumers and lowering costs and having more independence and resilience, the sun has come out. And so I feel like that's a very nice analogy for the conversation we've just had. Karen, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.